You're listening to Face Off, episode 22, recorded June 14th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this show, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com or follow us at Twitter by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark, let's just dig into it. We don't really have any news and follow-ups today. There's a lot of news items, but too many to cover, it seems like these days. So the first web app that we want to talk about is called Wordnik, which is WRIDNIK.com. And what Wordnik does is it's basically an online dictionary program, but it gives you a lot more aggregate information. Yeah. So for example, I searched for subscribe, which hopefully all our listeners are doing right now.
Go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe.
Yeah, I don't think you can search Wordnik for that, though.
We tried, though.
Actually, yeah, face-off is not in there, because I think the technical definition of face-off is two words, not one. Yeah, the hockey term is the words combined.
We're going to add it to the dictionary. Anyways.
So what Wordnik does, you know, you search for a word, and but what you first see when you kind of search for a word is you'll see things like the definitions from various dictionaries, such as the first one that it shows is the American Heritage Dictionary. It's got like 10 definitions of the word subscribe on it. You can look at other dictionaries like the Century Dictionary, Webster's Unabridged from 1913, apparently, and WordNet, and look at the different definitions of that. I think it picks the one that has the most definitions.
Well, the one from 1913, that might be interesting to see if the word has evolved over time.
Exactly.
Which I think the whole point of Wordnik is to know as much about the word and where it came from as possible.
Yeah.
Pronunciations. They even have like a chart down here, statistics of what years it was popular. It's like this little bubble chart.
Yeah, which is really interesting. Like the word wasn't super popular apparently until the 1920s, like early 1900s, 1920s, and then mm-hmm. it really kind of exploded. And it almost died between 1980 and now.
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
Like, but it's almost like as the internet kind of, and RSS's popularity, I think, bubbled up, the word became much more common in use. I'm not sure how they get this data, if it's, you know, maybe looking through a bunch of curated, literature throughout the years and kind of aggregating it or not. But it's definitely interesting to see different words and, mm-hmm. and kind of when they started and when they were popular. It does all kinds of other stuff, too. Like, it'll do an automatic Twitter search for the word and give you kind of, like, the last tweets that use that word.
42 seconds ago, somebody said, even want to subscribe, or, you know. So it even matches not just subscribe, but, like, derivatives of the word.
Yeah, I think Miss Moo was talking about subscribing to Face Off. I don't know. It's got examples of it used, you know, in literature, such as the story of my life being reminiscent of 60 years of public service in Canada. Some book, you know, where the guy says he expressed himself happy with the opportunity to subscribe. And he said, so lots of examples, related words, you know, such as looking at thesauruses and cross references, related words. Law is related to subscribe. It must be used in a lot of law publications.
They even have Flickr images that relate to the word. That's cool.
So. Yeah, which some words it almost doesn't make sense. Like subscribe, there's pictures of dogs and clouds. I don't, you know, it's not super intelligent. It's just aggregating information from mm-hmm. various sources the easiest way possible, which can be useful if you're looking for, you know, let's see. You lived in a hole, or you lived in, you know, in a fallout shelter for the last 100 years, and you didn't know what a dog was. Well, there's gonna be a lot of pictures of dogs, and you can kind of see what a dog is.
Yeah,
you know, or just something you don't know. It gives you at the bottom. There's like kind of etymology is the study of word history. So the word subscribe was derived from Middle English subscribin, to sign, from Latin subscribere. You know, give you a little history as to where the word history came from.
Uh-huh.
It's just really cool. It aggregates a lot of information. You can have, of course, pronunciations.
Subscribe.
Which that it's kind of the Stephen Hawking version of subscribe.
It's kind of social. It's got like the recently viewed, you know, favorite words. That's always exactly. handy. You know, you can tag words. You've got popular words that's going on right now, so you can kind of see trends. kind of like, you know, Twitter has trends and things. You can see what words people are looking up. Or
yeah, exactly. It'll tell you using a lot. Like the word subscribe has been looked up on WordNik 12 times. So it's really cool. It's just a good way. You know, I mean, I tend to just go dictionary.com and then get the you know, the definition, which I can then get to, you know, a thesaurus mm-hmm. if I want to see a word. But this is cool because it combines it all into one spot for you. It goes out to the internet and grabs what it can and sucks it into one spot for you.
Yeah, it's got the definition on there, so there's really no reason why not to use it, really.
Yeah, because you might find other
even
things.
If you're going to do a quick dictionary lookup, you can just look it up, and then something might catch your eye while you're already there.
Well, do you ever listen to, I'm kind of a big NPR fan, and they have a show on there called Christy the Wordsmith.
Oh.
She's actually from Bozeman, Montana,
no
I believe,
way.
Lives here. Yeah, and she, you know, she does basically word etymologies, like looking at words and where they came from.
I think you were telling me about that. A lot of people mispronounce the chomping at the bit. The term chomping
at
the bit.
Yeah, it's actually champing at the bit. Yeah. She'll look up phrases and stuff, not just words, but yeah, that's where you can hear things like that.
I remember listening to Leo on like This Week in Tech or something, and they were arguing about whether it was chomping or champing, and of course Leo said champing.
Well, the funny part is about the English language is it does evolve so much. Like mispronunciations get integrated into the English language to the point where they're in the dictionary sometimes, and it's kind of goofy because it may have started as champing at the bit, but so many people say chomping at the bit, mm-hmm. and it makes sense. Chomping, you know, if you're like, I think about it is if you're a horse and you have a bit in your mouth, you know, and you're ready to go, you're probably going to be chomping at it, ready to go. You know, and it gets funny how the English language just kind of integrates its mistakes so easily.
Yeah.
You know, what is it in the Webster dictionary now? The term McJob is in there, and it's kind of, in my opinion, depressing. It shouldn't be, I don't think, a phrase that should be in our dictionary, but. You know, I'm soon you'll be able to look up tweet and things like that in the dictionary, and it just kind of makes me wonder sometimes. I don't know. Who decides that? You know, people in England. But that's WordNik. It's really cool. It aggregates a bunch of information. You can log in, create an account. You can add tags to Word to try and make it easier for people to look for similar words where maybe an outside source isn't as accurate as it should be. You can put in your own examples and stuff. But if you want to use it like I do, just log in and look up stuff. You don't have to log in. Just go to the webpage and look it up. You'll get your dictionary and much more.
And I don't see it, but I'm willing to bet they have a Firefox like search thingy where you can just add it to your bar.
Yeah, instead of just the default dictionary.com.
If they don't, I'm sure they do, but if they don't, they should make one.
Well, I mean, yeah. The funny part is a lot of this is, I almost wish they would do some Wikipedia integration too, because I look up a lot of words on Wikipedia as well.
Good call.
So it'd be kind of nice because the thing is, the cool thing about it actually is it will let you search for anything, whether or not it has it. It doesn't come up with a I'm sorry page.
It'll just aggregate like, what it's got.
Yeah, exactly. Like no matter what, if you search for something, like we search for face off and it says the definition doesn't exist yet in WordNik, it'll still look up Twitter for face off and it'll look up Flickr for face off and it'll look up other places. So.
Okay. I was just looking here, and if you log in, you can actually leave notes and things about the word too. So
yeah. So help people out, you know, but WordNik. Check it out. I think it's worth a I think I'm going to integrate it into my word looking up as opposed to like dictionary.com.
Sure.
All right. So the next thing we want to talk about is called PassPack, which you can go to passpack.com. Mark, what is PassPack?
So PassPack is like an online password manager and sharing tool. What's unique about it is the security features about this. I mean, It's a really cool tool to basically, a lot of people are using email to send a quick password, like, hey, here's a password to log into our website. Can you do some quick changes or something? We know that, email is not secure. Mm-hmm. This kind of, you know, allows you to share passwords with some sort of like encryption key that only you know. They don't even know it.
Yeah.
And so you can securely say, hey, here's the password. Go over here to find it.
Well, at its core, it's a password storage website. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of desktop applications that do this.
Right.
There's a lot of Post-it notes in the world doing this right now, just where you store your password. You know, security experts are always trying to tell you use a different password for everything. Use really long, complicated passwords mm-hmm. that aren't in the dictionary that are hard to crack. And so it's kind of this give and take of usability versus security. Mm-hmm. And an application like this helps you because you can have big, long, hairy passwords or you can have really hard to remember stuff, but you can store it here and get to it anywhere mm-hmm. and look at your password. So, you know, if you haven't used it in a year, which one thing I want to talk about where this is really useful is a company that's doing something like, or a person doing freelance work or web work where you have all your customers' credentials for their, you know, their web stuff, their MySQL stuff.
Right.
You know, you have all that and you don't want to just leave it in a file in your office because you never know. It could get broken into. It could get lost, something like. So you could store all this here and get to it when you need it and take care of it.
Right.
Without storing it on,
I mean, yeah. As a freelancer, you're gonna have, I mean, you're gonna have so many passwords. I mean, it's either this: you're gonna, you know, use the same one for everything, which is, I mean, that's bad. Or you're gonna store it somewhere. I mean, that's basically two schools of thought on passwords. If you make them really complicated, people just write them down.
Exactly.
If you make them too simple, you know, then people,
then it's easy to crack or easy to break. You know, if it's your dog's name or something like that.
So this is cool. I mean, you could say, you know, give this person this password for X amount of time. You can revoke it.
The paid accounts, actually, you can create one account and multiple people can log into it. Multiple usernames can get to one account. So let's say you have, like if we created a Face-Off corporate account where we had all our Face-Off passwords, well, instead of individually sharing each password to all the different usernames, these people just log in and they're part of that account but with their own username. So, you know, if you have, and their pricing plans do vary. I think like the basic one is like a $1.90 something, or it's like a pound, an English pound a month, and you pay yearly. You know, you get three people, so three people can log into the same account. It's really good for something like that because, like at work, we were trying to figure out how we want to do this, and we were thinking of using like a, you know, one of those password encryption saving programs that they have, you know, for like Linux and OS X and Windows. They have them, but we were thinking like, okay, well, we'll take that encrypted password file and like sync it via Subversion, which would work, but this is a good alternative. And the one thing, you know, when I first showed it to you, you were like, well, I don't know about this. I mean, and we looked into it and they're pretty hip on security. I mean, these guys are doing a lot of stuff.
Yep. So like one of the things you'll notice about the security is like the encryption is done client side. They don't know your key.
Well, it's got like so many multiple levels of encryption. So all your passwords and information are stored in what they call the pack, which is stored on their side encrypted. And so when you log into the website, what you do is you put in your username and password, so they make sure it's you. And then they send you your encrypted pack. They send this pack of information with all your passwords and stuff that is encrypted with different levels of encryption. You can set AES 256, AES 128, or just, you know, some regular hashing algorithms, depending on how, you know, the more your security, the longer it takes to decrypt it, let's say client side. But it sends all those across an HTTPS encrypted connection on the internet to you, where then you have to put in this thing that you created at the beginning to unlock it, which they don't store. Yeah. So when you
encrypt it back and give it back to them, you're sending just the encryption part. You're not sending the key.
Exactly. So, I mean, what they say is when you sign up, they say, what is it called? Your pass pack or something like that? Your pack pass?
Yeah.
It's like a sentence or something. And what it is...
Package key, I think.
And what they say is, don't lose this or forget this. Because if you call us up and say, hey, I forgot my password for this...
They can't reset it.
They can't do it. They can't. They don't know it. It's not them.
It's real encryption. It's true.
Exactly.
They're not saving it. They don't have a back door.
Exactly. So, there's a lot of encryption going on. It's kind of nervous that it's client side, because you never know if you could have spyware or something going on. But they also have a really cool feature that we were playing around with, so that if you are going on a computer you think may be compromised, you're okay. What is that feature called, Mark?
So they have something that's called a disposable password and package key combination. So let's say you're going to go on vacation. You're going to travel somewhere. What you can do is ahead of time, if you know you're going to be on like risky networks or a computer that you don't trust, you know, you're out of the country and you've got to log into some hotel computer. You have no idea
what you
security
just never
these
know.
Guys have. And you want to get access to your passwords, but you don't want to, this is like a master key. Like if they get this password, they get all your other passwords. So it's got to be secure. So what they've got is the disposable password and key combination. What you do is before you go travel, or, you know, you don't have to travel. You can use this for whatever. But before you go to travel, you generate, I don't know, five or however many disposable package combinations. And then you print them out on a piece of paper and like put them in a wallet or something. As soon as you go log into a computer and you use the password to log in and your username, Oh, by the way, they have to know your username. So if somebody finds a piece of paper, it's useless.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, the piece of paper is probably just going to have the numbers and the combinations on it. It's not going to say the website.
It's going to look really random. Like it's going to look, it'll look really random. They'll just see a bunch of lines with what looks like garbly goop text. Right. And they're just going to be like, oh, okay, well, whatever.
So what you're going to do is you're going to take the first line on there and you're going to, so you're going to put your username and then you're going to put the first password in there. And then it's going to say, now put in your disposable package key. As soon as you log in, you have access just like you would if you normally type in your normal password. But now since you're on this vulnerable computer, or, you know, potentially vulnerable computer, this is a one-time thing. So you just logged into this key. It is it's gone. You cannot log into that key anymore. So you go literally with a pen and cross that out because you can, on your piece of paper because you can't use it anymore.
Yeah. After you use that key once, you could literally go up to someone and be like, "My name is so and so on this website. Mm-hmm. This is the password. This is the packing key, and it will be absolutely no use to them."
Yep. So for example, so you log in and you see your passwords and you can do all your things. Now let's say that computer was vulnerable, exploited or, had a worm or something and it was keylogging.
A keylogger. Yeah, exactly. That's
and it tried to replay. They call it, like a replay attack. They tried to take those credentials and try to log back in with the same credentials. It would just fail.
Yeah.
So it's a great feature.
That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. If, the joke was when we first started recording, Face Off, I had Windows on that laptop that you're using. Yeah. And it may have had something. I think it did. And you were always really nervous about logging into your stuff. This would kind of help mitigate. I mean, it still doesn't. If you log into PassPack with your disposable keyword and get your Gmail password, and then go log into Gmail with that password, it still could be. But they won't get access to your PassPack account. PassPack has done a really good job of trying to make this super secure. I think it's really cool. So you log in and you add a password. And some of the things you have to fill in when you put in a password is, a name, generic name. Like I have on here, our Face Off Twitter account, our user ID is Face Off Show. I put in our password and then I put in the link to log in. Okay. And then I put in, other important. So like they have an email field because sometimes to log in instead of a username, it's an email, no big deal. You can put in notes, if you want to put a note about it. Like I was thinking if you did someone else's MySQL credentials, you could be like, this is only allowed from these, hosts, or something, all kinds of notes. There's different options. Like you can make it a favorite or you can here's where you select the security level, like triple, double or single. Or you can share. This is the other thing we talk about. So they've done a lot about security. Like you cannot share until you go into your settings and enable password sharing. Like you go in and say, I want to be able to share passwords with people. So you can't accidentally share with someone.
So it's very manual. I mean, you have to do most of this stuff. Yeah. I mean, you have to tell it, yes, I'm going to allow this. It's not going to be something that's automatic.
I can't share a password with someone who has not already gone in and said that they want to share passwords. Then you have to create a relationship with that person that, you both know each other and want to share a password with each other. And then you go in and manually share that password with that person. So it seems clunky, but it's designed so that you can't do it accidentally. what if you accidentally shared your, Amazon password with someone and you have all your information set up for one-click checkout? Well, boom, 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 there you go. They can go in, change the address, and then one-click checkout and get all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and they have a lot of anti-phishing stuff too.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I'm trying to log in right now, and it's asking me to. There's like one, six or seven squares, and it's like, which one's the black square?
One of them is colored in black, and you have to click it. So you can't be a robot. That's kind of a robot thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a JavaScript thing. A lot of robots don't have JavaScript. I think what it's doing is adding a class to the box and the div.
Yeah.
And so then once you click on that, you got to put your packaging key in, which they don't know. I mean, it's going to be stored client side for your encrypted packet. So what else can you do?
Also, when you unpack in, you can go into your settings and set up your welcome message. So by default, when a person goes to log in, it says like, hello, username, welcome to, PassPack. Well, you can change that welcome to PassPack to whatever you want. So if I know, like I said mine, I was like, hey, good looking. I know if I go to a website that looks like PassPack and when I go to log in, if it doesn't say, hey, good looking in big red text, I know that it's phishing. It's not them. And I should be aware of that.
Another feature that I'm looking at here is somebody doesn't have a PassPack account yet and you want to just share something really fast, you can actually send a password through email that's encrypted.
Oh, really?
I'm looking at it now. I think they'll have to actually click on a link, maybe and enter a PIN or something. Mm-hmm. But Yeah, that's
cool. Oh, that's great. That's so they. I mean, one of the annoying parts is
you don't want to sign.
Perhaps
up.
Annoying. Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, well, if you want this password, you have to sign up, and I have to share it with you, which is kind of a clunky process. This is a way to kind of like send it off to them really quick. There's just it's a lot of little things like by default when you look at a password, it doesn't show it. You know, you have to click a show button before you know because you well, you and I know when you see your password in clear text, you just about have a heart attack.
Oh yeah,
you're like so here it's like I have to manually go and click show and then it's like okay hide it oh god okay, oh show hide oh god it just makes
well
me
somebody
nervous.
Could be looking over your shoulder
you yeah
know?
Exactly it tells you you know your relative password strength. You can suggest a password where so it'll generate a secure password for you. It's also got really cool things like a bookmarklet that you can put up. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the website and you click log into this with Passpack, it'll look for that URL where you put in your password and fill it in for you so that you don't have to see your, if you're nervous about seeing your password, you don't have to do that.
They also have a desktop app that integrates with it. It's an Adobe Air application, so it's going to work cross-platform. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. So
I mean, that's kind of the problem with the desktop ones is, I mean, you got to kind of sync them across different computers.
Exactly.
And
if you and if they ever do offer a syncing system, I'm hoping that it's as smart and secure as this because this is really clever.
Yeah, it seems like the first one that actually has everything everything tied together, all the the loose ends tied together.
Yeah, and it has everything we like. It has a basic free account. You can store up to 100 passwords for free. You can get up to I think 5 disposable logins for free. And then after that, you have to start paying. So it's got really good basic free account. I mean, the free account will work for me for my personal stuff, no problem. But if I was going to do business stuff like we're talking about development or freelancing, I would, of course, I'd pay for a pro account for this because it's cheap and it's very useful.
So my favorite feature about this web app is definitely going to be the disposable password. I think that is really neat. I haven't seen that I can think of right now. I can't think of any web app that does it.
Yeah.
Currently. I mean, I've heard of people wanting to implement that sort of technology, but that's really cool. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. So check it out. It's Passpack. One of the things we were thinking of, I mean, Mark and I kind of glazed it over and looked at the security. It seems to be really good. These guys seem to be doing a lot of stuff. But one thing we want to do is we're both a fan of like security expert Steve Gibson. We were thinking maybe he could take a look at it. And I mean, just word opinions, or if any of our listeners, if you guys have any thoughts or concerns or ideas about this, I'd like to know because, I mean, it is doing a very sensitive thing. I mean, the fact that one thing you were talking about is inherently for this product, they have to store my password. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of places like Mint will store a hash of your password to log in, which most websites will use. And so they never actually know your password because you do it and they hash it and send it off. I mean, inherently, this service has to keep a clear text version of your password because that's its purpose, is for me to go and look at a password. So it's really dangerous.
I mean, I don't think it actually does have to store your password. It stores an encrypted hash of your password, which the only way to decrypt it is that key.
True.
And if it's client side, when you say, show me my password, they're sending an encrypted blob to you, and then your computer is decrypting that, and then you see it. I think that's how it's working.
But you're still seeing it in clear text in some way. I mean, it's...
I don't think they are seeing it.
No, they aren't, but it's just... That's the nervousness of this system, is that, you know...
Yeah.
You know, like if you work with Linux, you get used to sending people your password from the shadow file so you can log into the box, or sending them your login encryption key. You know, no big deal because it's always hash. You're like, oh, well, they'd have to have them, you know, if you have a good password, they'd have to have a massive rainbow table to figure out what my password is. Well, services like this make people uneasy, such as myself, just because in general there is my password for people to see and people to use. It's not a hash. It's not going to take a lot of work. If someone looks at over my shoulder at the wrong time when I click show, they're going to see my clear text password. But
or if you had,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, since it is client side, or we're assuming it's client side, there could be something that could see the clear text after it's been encrypted.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, but after you and I sat here and played around with it for a while and talked it over as we were looking at it, I feel a lot more secure about these guys. It seems like they're doing a lot of really good stuff. I'm really happy that they're doing that. It seems good.
I've looked at a lot of password managers. Most of them are desktop applications. I think this is more secure than some of those even.
Yeah. So, and I mean, we kind of did some searches on the internet. There wasn't a lot of people screaming that this was terrible. Don't use it. I couldn't find any. It was most, you know, it was featured in Lifehacker, NBC, I think New York Times. You know, it seems to be a pretty big service that people are using, and I would, without a doubt, if I needed it, I would pay for this. I think it's a great service.
All right. So that was our last web app. So now we're gonna dive into the topics.
Actually, it isn't. We've got one more that you forgot about.
How did I forget about this one?
I know this is pretty cool. Our next web app is called docstock.com. It's docstoc.com. And what it is a big repository of stock documents. I mean, all kinds of public domain documents, legal documents, articles, slideshows, PDFs. There's a lot of stuff. And where I really found the usefulness of this was legal documents. I mean, legalese and small contracts and stuff are pain.
Yep, forms, tax stuff, real estate, all that stuff.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of things that even sort of, this is going to sound rude, but, you know, the common man like me, just a regular Joe, sometimes needs a legal document and can't write it up. So, like, my great example was a bill of sale for a car. If I sell a car to someone, for the most part, whenever I do a bill of sale, it's like a piece of paper that's like, I, Jade Robbins, am purchasing this vehicle on this date for this much money. Mm-hmm. Maybe you put the VIN, you know, you put the VIN on there and then sign it. And that's good enough to go get a title.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, I just out of the blue, I searched and I found a contract uploaded by an attorney that is a bill of sale for a private party contract for a motor vehicle. And it's got a lot of the bases covered that you wouldn't think of, like, agreement between, you know, put the seller and the buyer's information, the year, make, model, color of the car, the VIN, the odometer, the license plates, the sale of the price. And then good things like, you know, the buyer knowingly accepts the risk inherent of owning and operating a motor vehicle. You know, whereas, like, you know, a regular bill of sale will get you a title and maybe would hold up in court. But this, I mean, if something happened, this looks pretty good.
It's better than what most people probably do.
Yeah,
so.
Well, better than I did before, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, I could see where this is going to be useful in legal situations that are often like the amateur style stuff, like you're going to rent your house out, like a rental agreement, yep, something exactly. like that. You know, there's also lots of articles on technology and in all kinds of categories that they've got: legal, business, finance, technology, education. Jobs, career, so I'm sure they might have some resume templates or like...
Yeah, I'm kind of exploring while we're talking here. This guy's a lawyer uploading documents. I clicked, you know, other docs by this user. Dispute letter to a credit reporting agency.
Ooh.
A follow-up to a dispute letter to a credit reporting agency, like if they give you the Stonewall, a request for a credit report from a credit reporting agency. I mean, that's cool. It's like, this guy's a lawyer, so I was like, well, what other docs is he uploading? Boom, there's some more good generic awesome. Letters that have, you know, you're not going to shoot yourself in the foot by not sounding legal.
Yeah, no, that's great. Like copyright violations are a perfect example. Oftentimes the first email is enough to stop, you know, like somebody's publishing one of your articles or something and they didn't have permission. Mm-hmm. Just send them a quick email, you know, and this is like the perfect thing for that. Just look up something that somebody's already drafted up. It's going to sound a little bit more official than something you're going to just come mm-hmm. up with in your head real quick, you know, unless you're a lawyer.
And each doc, they're pretty particular about copyright. So like this document that we were just talking about, the motor vehicle one, it's a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution license. I can share, I can transmit the work, no problem. I can adapt the work, I can change it how I want, but I need to give credit to the original author. Well, that's great. I mean, I'm cool with that. There's a lot of them out there that are public domain. So like any forms that are created by the government are all public domain. So it can get confusing sometimes. There are a lot of docs for specific states or regions, like, you know, St. Louis City Council, you know, things. Mm-hmm. But it's an easy way to find things. I like it.
So why don't you tell us about, like, how they monetize or what's the incentive? Tell me how they've already gotten 3 million public documents on here.
Well, one of the cool way that they really do this is if you upload a document, you can sign up to get ad revenue sharing for that document. So on each document, when you view it, there's some Google ads at the top and the bottom, which with a lot of these, I think Google ads really make sense here because, you know, sometimes you get a lot of Google ads like find templates for a document. And you're like, well, that's what I'm doing here.
That's what I'm doing here.
But sometimes if it's like a vehicle, you know, a motor sale vehicle one, there's also links to like, Carfax, you know, get a Carfax report. Well, that's useful. I'm selling a car. I want to get the Carfax.
Yep.
But if you upload the document, you can sign up to get ad revenue sharing for that. So if you are a lawyer and you put up a really good document, you know, you give yourself attribution on the copyright, if a ton of people use it, if it's a really useful document and they're getting a lot of ad revenue, they share part of that with you. So you get money back. You're incentivized to put up good documents. I think this is why a lot of people are putting up these public domain documents, because all they're literally doing is going through the hassle of putting up a document that the government has put out, and they can get ad revenue sharing from it as well because they went through the work of uploading it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great incentive for, you know, getting...
I bet the guy who uploaded the 1040 EZ tax form is just raking in the dough.
But, yeah, but those need to be updated, so...
Yeah, every year. I'm going to get on it first. That's going to be me. It's really cool. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on there that sometimes you're kind of like, well, I don't know how useful that is. Like articles. Basically, someone went on the web, printed out an article, and PDF'd it and uploaded it. And you're like, well, that's kind of cheesy. But it's really easy to sort of drill down and see what you want. Like, by default, the ones I'm the more interested in are legal documents. So I click on legal. There's featured legal documents at the top, like, you know, Proposition 8 ruling, the official legal document for the Proposition 8 ruling. But you can also drill down to business formation contracts. Like if I want to create an LLC or an S-Corp, actually, I'm interested in this. So I'm going to go to S-Corp, and there's like partnership registrations, S-Corp, corporation tax forms. And then so I can go like, oh, I want to sort by highest rated or most downloaded, because that's probably going to be the most useful form. How to start? Well, most downloaded is actually how to start a business in Oregon. So that's not very useful. But it's, you know, it's easy to drill down. It's easy to look at things. If they're rated highly, you can sort by ratings. You can just sort by the most viewed if there's a lot of things going on. And it's really...
Yeah, it's got a very social aspect to it. Reviews on the, you know, most downloaded, most reviews, most popular, most, you know...
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it really helps you weed out some of the articles that aren't very helpful.
Yeah. Well, like, so, you know, I mean, I like the reason I would go to a site like this, to be honest, is because I want easy legal docs. I want... things like a PDF or a PowerPoint on how to do something I can live without or find on the internet. But I want to look like I want to find, I want to find legal documents easily. So that's where I'm going to go. I don't have to look at all that other junk if I don't want to.
Okay. I just found something interesting browsing around. They have a collections tab. And so it's like collections with a common theme. So like starting a business, you click on that.
Oh, wow.
And it's going to have... all the different forms for how to start one, how to hire a lawyer,
raising money for a startup company. Oh my gosh!
Insurance for small business, and like a little bit of what to look for. You know, state taxes. You know,
yeah.
So common themes kind of stuff.
Wow, yeah, that's really cool. So let's look at starting a small business one. These are great. There's kind of like some like. Information type PDFs in there.
Yeah, Mason.
There's a small business handbook by by OSHA for, you know, if you want to be in compliance for work standards, hiring a lawyer, tax guide for small business, insurance for small business, human resources. Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is all the stuff you're going to need. So, I mean, it's
very cool. I think this is a great site. I'm pretty pumped about it, to be honest with you.
I've always wondered when there was going to be an app for legal documents. I didn't think it was going to be, I mean, this one's got everything.
Yeah.
I was thinking there's going to be web app just for legal documents, like rental agreements and things, and this one's got everything. So it's really great.
Yeah, and
I'm glad we found it.
I mean, a lot of these, you don't have to take directly, but let's say, I mean, you go on here, you're trying to figure out how you want to write your rental agreement. Go look at 10 different rental agreements and see what they have in them that you like and things that you don't. You know, some of these are really legalese, and let's say if I was renting a place, I wouldn't want... I want my renters to be able to read the document in a normal form, but I still want to cover my bases. So that way I could create my own document if I wanted to that hit all the notes that I need to for a proper rental agreement, you know, by looking at all 10 of these. Some of them are like obviously big property management company rental agreements, and some are, hey, you know, my mm-hmm. buddy is my roommate rental agreements. So you can get all aspects.
One way I found really quick to weed out some of these articles, you can actually go in under documents, you can click templates and just see templates.
Okay, so not like filled out documents, like just
like,
templates.
Yeah, like financial statement, like so if you wanted a blank one or something, affidavit of disclosure, just forms, 2009 California, Arizona, Alabama, you know, all these different types of tax forms, and so things you need to fill out.
Yeah. Wow. So, there are fair warning though, pretty much every public domain doc is up on here. So there's a lot of Arizona, a lot of California, a lot of Colorado state docs. But you can filter usually those by most viewed and stuff. I mean,
they have an API.
They do have an API, which we always love. So you, I mean, the funny part is we look at all these web apps with APIs, and all I can think about is how when I create my own internal office application in Rails, you know, to like manage my own small business, how I'm going to integrate with every god dang API out there as much as possible. There's going to be, you know, I'm going to have like a DocStock part where I can import docs from DocStock, and then I'm going to have, you know, a Twitter part. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, but I don't know. There's a lot of cool tools that come out of APIs. Just look at all the Twitter tools that came out.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you can, yeah, very useful. DocStock.com.
All right, let's go into our topics. We've got the first one we've got is basically, you know, web contract.
Yeah, yeah. This actually, it's a perfect transition from DocStock because a lot of times when you're doing web work, you really need to make a contract. And you have to make sure you have everything that you need because you can really get burnt if you don't. I mean, I've done some work with some really professional people who even then have gotten burnt because they didn't have everything properly in a contract. So we kind of tend to think about project management stuff. At least I do, I guess, because I'm kind of a project manager. But, you know, making sure that you have all the features ready and everything like that. But there's also a lot of little things. We found an article that has some commonly, I wouldn't say commonly missed things, but essentials to have in your web contract. So I thought we might go and look through that and see some of the things that they had to say about that.
Okay. The first one we've got is pricing terms. Usually, I mean, even if you're not doing a web contract, you usually negotiate some sort of price. Either
that's usually the reason you create a comment or a contract is because you want to get paid.
Yeah. I mean, it's usually, you know, by the hour for the entire project or whatever. You've got something there. You know, they go into detail about, you know, having a hybrid pricing model, you know, whether it's going to be, this is the base price. And if I start adding stuff on, it's going to be this or, you know,
yeah, and
this is going to be the additional hours.
That kind of gets hairy because like sometimes you give a quote or an estimate and you kind of have to make sure that you say, well, make sure this is not a bid. It's an estimate. And if the price goes up, I'm going to charge you accordingly. You have to have that sorted out. But what goes along with that, not only what they're going to pay, but how they're going to pay, payment terms. Are they going to be paying quarterly? Are they going to be paying, are you going to send monthly invoice statements?
Can you do a down payment before you start?
A down payment, yeah, which I would agree or argue that is pretty important. I mean, you need to get a chunk of money first to make sure they're serious because a lot of customers forget that web work is work like any other work, and there's risk to you as well for taking on this project and putting your time and money into it.
Yeah, I would probably recommend a minimum hour or a minimum down payment charge of some sort, whether it's the first couple hours or something.
Yeah. And if you're going to invoice, we have all kinds of apps that'll invoice. We talked about Less Accounting, Billing Boss, you know, web-based ways to send an invoice to someone and keep track of your invoices,
Billing
whether
Boss
or not they've paid. Number three is project workflow. This is important because like a lot of times when you'll start a project with a customer, they want you to dig into it right away. They want to see pages. They want to see your coding. They want to see your results and they want to start analyzing it. Mm-hmm. And you need to let them know ahead of time that there are steps involved before that. You can't just dive in and start writing code. You have to research. You have to look at your architecture. You want to make some templates or make some designs, some design architecture diagrams and stuff.
Another thing, I mean, if you have some of this stuff up front, they know what to expect. So like, if let's say you've already built them for 4 hours, but you haven't wrote, you know, one piece of code, they're going to, if you didn't have something like this, they might be like, what are you doing?
Yeah. They're like, where is it? Well, then let me see your code. And you're like, well, no,
I don't have code yet.
I'm researching the proper, you know, you're asking me to interface with a piece of hardware that hasn't been interfaced in this way before. Like, let's say a shipping label for UPS PHP, like you've been working on. That's going to take some research. You have to research that piece of hardware, how it's going to work, and you're not writing code, so you can't.
Right.
There's no tangible deliverable to give them for that, and
right.
They might be like, "Well, you build me. Where's my deliverable? Give me something to look and feel." And you're like, "Well, no, it's
what
in
they,
my head."
But what they don't know is if I would have just jumped in and coded without, I would have been wasting their time and money,
and your estimate would be out the window because your estimate included, you know.
So yeah, I think this is very sound advice of doing a project workflow. You know, include things like, you know, your research, how long is it going to take to, you know, I mean, I think a lot of good programmers, you know, think about it in their head and you know, draft stuff out, use user ability surveys and things to figure out, like, what do we actually need, what, you know, before they actually start getting into the code.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have, not only you're going to write the code, but they're saying stuff like, you know, you got to have the integration, or you got to, you know, test it after it's integrated. You know, some of that stuff should be, you know, in the project. It shouldn't be just, like, I'm going to write the code and I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Cause, and they talk about that in number 5, which is, and I'm just going to skip to that. We'll go back to 4, but maintenance agreements. A lot of times, again, it's like, I write the code, I'm done. A lot of companies, like especially where I work at MSU, where we were doing programming before, maintenance agreements were not something that we really thought about. And so it ended up that there was no agreement, so they would just call us 2 years later when the application really should have been deprecated. And they're like, well, this doesn't work anymore, fix it. And you're like, well, and then you bill them hourly, and it's like, you know, you also need to value your time that you... It keeps it on your plate. It keeps it on their plate, so that they don't just wait until it's totally broken to call you. If one little thing's wrong, they're probably going to say, like, well, I have a maintenance agreement, so I'm going to pay for them to look at this, and it'll keep you fresh on it. Maybe you can say, well, just so you know, this application is getting old. It also gives you the opportunity to cut it off.
Yeah. I was just going to say that technology is moving so fast. You need a cutoff date, an expiration date on software, unless you're maintaining it every single, you know, monthly or quarterly, like constantly. Mm-hmm. You know, like let's say you build a program and then, you know, you provide a year of tech support, but then like nothing really goes wrong.
Yep.
But after that year, you got to expire it. Because
Well, you don't even have to expire it, but you say, this technology is so old, I'm going to have to charge you a much, much higher maintenance price to keep up with it, because mm-hmm. not only am I learning Ruby on Rails, I have to also keep fresh on, ASP 2.0 that was phased out 4 years ago because of your app, and that doubles my time. I have to do that, so it's going to cost you a lot more money.
Yeah, like... A good example is like before, you know, a lot of these APIs were XML, they used, you know, some other format, and, you know, that's just not the way to do it anymore. You know, you might end up having to like rewrite the entire thing mm-hmm. after a certain period of time has gone by.
Yeah, exactly.
So expirations are not always necessary, but they're usually
you just set up a maintenance contract to review it again in the future and meet with that customer and let them know. Plus, I mean, a lot of times these customers don't really know. So you're off doing work and they're off doing work and they don't even know that this program might be completely antiquated and is so out of place. And you're like, well, for half the time it took me to originally write this in a new framework, I could write it in half the time and have twice as many features that are really great. And they'd be like, oh, well, instead of paying you maintenance for 4 years, I'm going to give you a new job to rewrite it.
Yeah, well said.
So number 4 is timeline expectations. So, I mean, we skipped to 5, which was maintenance. Now back to 4. Timeline expectations, like you talked about, setting expirations, setting deadlines for yourself so that you have to, you know, try and... It just helps you gauge your progress. I'm a firm believer. I don't think timelines should be set in stone. Because, I mean, like, I've been kind of reading a lot of agile programming stuff, and what they do is instead of really setting hard, long deadlines, like, it's not Gantt chart at all. You know, your traditional project management style is like Gantt charts and hard deadlines for every phase. What it does is kind of create cycles in which you create functionality in that cycle and then review it at the end and work with the customer on it so that you can say, okay, well, by, you know, this phase one, we hope to have this done, but we'll review it at that point and kind of set time chunks as opposed to like hard dates.
Like 6 months from now, I better have this, 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 and this.
Yeah, this functionality, you know, in 1 month, we hope to have this basic functionality.
And if that works, then we'll go to the next thing and then you can kind of review it and say, yeah, I want you to continue with this, or you know what, this is taking a long time and I just want to abandon it.
Yeah. But make sure you have a timeline because you don't want it to keep scope creeping up and then 2 years later you're still working on the same old project. I mean, make sure you're getting paid for that work at least, but still, it just doesn't feel good for you. It doesn't feel productive. You like to, I'm especially in the type of person that I like to say, you know, version one, done. Hooray. I'm good. And that makes me feel a lot better. So.
The sixth one is kind of like a legal thing, kind of like maybe DocStock might have something, you know, a snippet of this or something, but it's called limited liability and indemnification.
That's a mouthful.
You know, if this project or something gets sued for something that you created, but it's not necessarily your, you know, who knows what. There's some nasty legal problems, and you can solve some of them at least by writing, you know, this into the contract.
Yeah, so I mean, let's say you wrote Facebook and then some girl had a stalker or something because of Facebook. You need to let them, it needs to be said that you wrote this for this company, and it's even though it's your software that was used,
it's the company
they
responsible
requested
for
exactly
that sort of it. You know,
exactly,
part of it.
And I think you're dead on when you say something like DocStock can help you out with this, especially these legalese sort of things. Get on DocStock, look at a bunch of examples, maybe even take an example, but or create your own. But it would be a great way to make sure that you're securing yourself from this, because you know, even though you have a contract, and you hope that in court, if you just had a normal contract without that, they would see that this person contracted you for work and it's not your fault.
Right.
But this way, it clearly lets it know that they can't even really take you to court for that. It'll get thrown out immediately because it's right here clearly in black and white.
It's one of those things that you're like, well, that'll never happen to me, but
exactly
those things happen. Yeah. And you know, you should probably have something like that.
Exactly. Number 7 is an arbitration clause. What this does is that it says if you have any disputes over the contract and whatnot, it says that you'll go to arbitration first so that you sort of avoid the big you know, court thing and all
it's
that. So
you
get in the news, bad press. It's a lot cheaper, exactly. A lot of times you end up paying like legal fees, whereas arbitration is a lot cheaper. And it just kind of, you know, basically speeds up the legal process if something like that happens.
Yep. You see these a lot in legal documents.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably something you can find on DocStock, I would imagine.
Again, DocStock would be great general. For this. Yeah.
Design credit agreement is the next one. You know,
you want to be able to say that you did this in your portfolio.
Sometimes they'll make you sign an NDA or something, and if you want to get credit for your work, you know, and that's not something you're interested in, you should make it up front. Mm-hmm. It should be up front whether or not you can say that you made it.
Exactly.
Yeah, basically.
Whether you want it or whether you don't want it, it needs to be up front and clearly stated that, you know, because let's say if you are a freelance, your portfolio is very important to you because that's your only way of showing anybody that you did any work.
True.
So you want to make sure that's in there. If you're a big company that has done a lot of really public work, you know, maybe you have your own sort of web apps that you put out there, you know, your quality of work is very easily stated. You don't need it in your portfolio. Then it doesn't matter to you. You could or you couldn't, but it needs to be clearly
should
in
be
your
clear
contract.
Before you start working. If you're expecting it, because maybe it's your first job.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And you're trying to build up a portfolio and you're expecting to get credit for it, you know, you got to have that up front.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean,
you don't want to do half the work and then they say, oh, by the way, we want you to sign this NDA.
Yeah, exactly. If they say, we don't want you to take any credit for this, then you're going to say, all right, it's going to cost you more money because I can't use that to go get more work.
Right.
9 is an additional expenses agreement. This is great just because sometimes, you know, if you have to travel or something, if you have to go to their offices somewhere else, you're going to say, well, then you're going to have to pay these additional expenses. Or if they want a piece of software that you don't have and you have to buy it.
It's saying stuff like specialized fonts. Like if they're like, hey, this is the font that we use, but we no longer have it. You know, like let's say it's the font they use on all their labels or like whatever. And they're like, well, we need it, but our other designer did this and he's got the font. We don't have it. You know?
Exactly.
And you didn't put that in your budget and you've got to now buy it, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Number 9 is a cancellation thing. Again, it just so that neither side can just up one day and say, you know, kiss off. I don't want to work with you anymore. There are repercussions to that, such as they need to pay you for that, the rest of that phase of work, whether or not it was completed, or you know, just a way to protect yourself and them. I mean, a lot of these things you have to remember protects them as well, because, you know, like the great one is the design credit agreement. If you didn't put that in there and then you go out and put that on their portfolio, let's say all of a sudden they look silly because it looks like they hired something out that they, you know, that they claim to do themselves.
Right.
And
also the cancellation, if they wanted to cancel it halfway through the project, the programmer could have been counting on it. They could have been, you know, this is my project. I don't want to cancel it. I wanted to get
paid.
Or
if you're a freelancer, okay, I have income for the next 4 months.
Yeah.
I can pay rent.
Yeah. Now you don't have that income.
Exactly.
There should be, I mean, it protects both sides, I would say.
I agree, definitely. Number 10, this is one I didn't expect in this article because a lot of it is really sort of common sense work stuff, but this is cross-browser compatibility. And that is, especially with web work, this is so key, and I wish I would have thought of this when I've done some of my web contracts in the past because, to me, I'm like, okay, Internet Explorer is the bottom, you know, right now. Let's say if I was designing something, I would say Internet Explorer 7, bottom line, what I would support because 6 is a mess. Well,
it's good to make that clear. Which ones you're going to cut off on? You're going to say, you know, I would say most designers nowadays are saying, you know, it's probably going to be cross compatible, but this is like saying, okay, how cross compatible? Are you going to support Opera 6 or 7 yeah, or exactly. 8 or 10 or, you know,
or what if, you know, one of the CEOs has like a little BlackBerry operating system and they're like, well, I thought it would look exactly the way it did on my BlackBerry. And you're like, well, no, that's the nature of the web.
I didn't know I was going to make a mobile version of the site, you know, or print.
Yeah, exactly. A print style. It's important because if you design everything and you're prepped for like Internet Explorer 7 and they come back a week later and say, oh, we had someone look at Internet Explorer 6 and it doesn't look right. Well, then you're like, okay, again, like you said, to how far does it go? Do you say that in older browsers it will be functional? Because it might not look right, but you can still use the site.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or do you want it to be the exact same? Because that's going to change the load of work. It's going to change your initial design concepts of the website. Things like what technology can use. Can you even use Ajax?
Right.
Can you even use Flash?
Are they going to say, I want it pixel by pixel? Perfect, or I want it basically the same, or you know, how well defined is it going to be?
Exactly.
Specify exactly what they're looking for.
Like in this article, they talk about, for example, the browser that used to come with AOL was like a cheap version of Internet Explorer 5, and you know, it's just things you can't think of. So clearly specify what it needs to look good in, and to what extent, and have it so you can prove it at the end. Like, here's a screenshot in this browser that we said we'd work with. Here's a screenshot in this browser. They all look the same. They all work.
Another reason to do this is it's going to take longer the more things you add. So you're going to say, hey, if you want support in these browsers, it's going to take longer time to program this.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's going to, well, it might not be any longer to program, but it might take longer to test and integrate.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And then you have to go tweak a few things. It's going to take longer for sure.
It's just going to add a lot more time. I have to find a computer that will run in Explorer 6. If you want me to test on a BlackBerry OS, I'm going to have a BlackBerry, which is another expense I don't have right now.
And if you tell this stuff to them ahead of time, they might say, okay, you know what? Fine. Let's just do the current browsers and we'll maybe do the BlackBerry depending on the time, you know? Just
or hopefully they'll say, what do you think? You're the expert. What do you think? And you can say,
well,
oh, thank God. No, Internet Explorer 7 is the lowest IE I should have support.
There you go.
Number 12 is client content. Again, this is really important to specify what content they're going to give. Sometimes like a lot of clients have their stuff together and they already have a bunch of stock photos that they want implemented. Other times they don't. Well, it's going to take you time to go out and hunt pictures that are that work for what you're looking for and are, you know, Creative Commons or free, you know, or wording. I mean, this is the biggest, like some clients are really specific about the wording. They want it to be exactly the way they wrote it in their Word document. It needs to look the same. It needs to have the same wording. And some aren't. Some say like, so this section, we want a blurb about the company. And you're like, okay, what's the blurb? And they're like, oh, you do it. Well, writing takes time. Writing is a pain in the butt. And so having to do that would really increase the workload.
One of the examples that is kind of funny, despite breathing down in your neck to make progress on the design and programming on your project, you need to engage in medieval torture methods to get any content out of them. Make sure you clearly indicate that any delay in delivery of content from the client will result in timeline delays. Like if you're looking for a certain font or label or some graphic image that they want in their project, but they're not giving it to you, you know, they have to go find it in their archives or something.
And yeah, exactly.
If it's their client content that they want in there, make sure you get all that stuff right ahead.
Yeah, we were working with a client who was what they were doing. We were creating the layout of the website, but the layout was really dependent upon the logo, and they were getting a professional design firm to create the logo. Well, they kept wanting to see like, well, how come the layout isn't updated? How come? What's the color scheme? What's going on? And we were saying, well, we can't. And so like their logo design got super delayed, like a couple months, and they were almost angry at. Or not angry, but they were like, well, how come this isn't changing? What's going on? It doesn't look great because, you know, by default, you make stock looking stuff so that you don't have to change a whole bunch later, right? Because you don't want to like do a bunch of fancy colors and then all of a sudden they're like, well, no, this is the color scheme we're going with. So we were like, we were delayed because of their content that they were supposed to give us. And you need to specify that will happen. That's, I agree, could totally important.
The 13th one is mistakes. You know, should they? I mean, if you make a mistake, it's your personal problem when you're designing the site. I mean, Are you going to make them pay for your mistake that you made? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, is it, do you just say, you know, clear the slate? Or if they
screw
up as well?
Are you going to have a 10 or 20%, you know, margin on timeline? Like, if you said it was within these hours and you're, like, way over because, you know, maybe you had to do a little bit of learning on something before you could get it done, is that kind of their fault or is that your fault?
Yeah.
You need to kind of, I mean, this is kind of like your... It's not, I don't know if it's in the web contract itself, but this is something you need to know, I guess, for yourself. Yeah. Some of it could be the contract, like the timeline shift.
Well, and again, this is sort of that thing where you say like, well, that won't happen. But, you know, even if you have the whole, you know, let's go to arbitration if something breaks, if you have this beforehand, let's say you could say like negotiation of how to handle this mistake will happen before X, Y, and Z. Then, you know, you're giving yourself those options in case something screws up. Because when you're, you know, designing the project, everything usually sounds hunky-dory. You're like, all right, things are great. I got a client that's going to pay me money to do work, and it's going to be so much fun. But let's say when you're 6 months into it later and there's been some, you know, some mistakes happen and there's some bad blood, it's not going to be that way. So you need to be prepared for the worst that could happen, even though you hope it doesn't.
Right. A good example, I mean, an easy example would be like you misspelled like five words on the site and they're just like, can you upload or fix these little pieces of, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Just fix it for free. Fix it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Don't you send know, me, don't me, don't I mean, send me an invoice problem. Where you say, I bill a minimum of 1 hour,
and,
you know?
And I fix these spelling mistakes that I shouldn't have had in there in the beginning.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Or the client mistakes. Let's say they sent you the content with the misspelling in it. You know, what happens there? Yeah. Both ways. It can go either way. Number 14 is assignment of the project. You need to be able to, if this happens, to say that you may subcontract the work out. But in the end, you know, you're responsible for the end product that goes to the user. But you could, you know, let's say you decide to take on an intern.
You know, I think the general theme of these things is being clear of what you
exactly
making your the client's expectations clear of what's going on. You know, if they think that you're going to be making it because they think you're some genius coder and you actually subcontracted and have a bunch of, you know, other coders and, you know, it's not what they expected, they might get angry at you.
Yeah,
it's going to make, and they might give you a bad review or, you know, whatever. Just make it clear that saying, hey, I might subcontract it. And it just, you know, resolves a lot of problems, potential problems.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it is having the foresight to say, and it's hard, I realize, to not make them mad by putting all this in there. Because sometimes you might get a client that says,
what is
you,
all this
you
stuff?
Think I'm going to screw you over or something? And yeah, you're like, well, you have to be clear. Like, well, you just never know what can happen. What if I got in a bus accident? You know, I got hit by a bus. You know, this protects you as much as it protects me. Let's say your company went into a financial crisis and this project was not important to you. It protects me as much as it protects you.
That is a very good point.
Yeah. The last one is a referral program. And this is, it's not essential, but it's a really good idea to say that, you know, if someone comes to them and they're like, man, I really wish I had a better internal management program like this. And they say, well, I know a guy who did a really good job for me. It's give them a cut of the cheese, you know?
Put it right in your contract. If you refer me some business, I will give you 5% of the project or whatever. Something like that.
Or like
it might help
you
get
do all kinds of stuff. Like I'll give you, you know, I'll take 2 months off your maintenance contract or something like that.
Trade or do whatever, you know. So it's a great way to build up your portfolio and get a name out there.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, that exactly. So I think you kind of hit it on the head. The name of the game is to be prepared. You can use a lot of things, like we talked about. DocStock would be a great way to go look at a bunch of examples of these sort of things. Look at them, see what you want, incorporate things that you think are useful. But you know, these are some pretty the tips that we went through are good things that you probably should have in your contract. And
if you're doing maintenance, store your passwords in PassPack. And
yeah, exactly. I mean, And just make sure that you have a good contract, because I think a lot of people get burnt like this. I mean, I've seen people that have been in business for a long time that can get burnt by some silly little things like this. So make sure you have them in there, and you know, of course, do good work and make your client happy and do what they want. But you know, if they don't do what you want, you have a recourse, and keep, you know, protect yourself. Like we said, protect yourself as much as you protect them, because it's very important. Well, that about does it for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind our listeners that you can subscribe to our show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to our website at faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can, you know, leave messages on the post themselves, you know, Twitter, email, you know, send us audio comments, give us follow-ups. You know, we do sometimes we skip the follow-up section at the beginning just because we don't have any. But if we miss something,
yeah, let us know.
Let us know. Hammer it to us, and we'll get it taken care of.
Yeah, we try to address any feedback. I mean, if whether it's a comment, a suggestion, a web app, we try to address all, I mean,
yeah, if not in the show, on the feedback mechanism, you know, we try to reply to every post on our blog that says, you know, check out these web apps. Like, I'll go look at them and say, hey, thanks. I might not talk about it on the show, but any help and support we can get from our listeners is great, and we love it. So, thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you next week.